supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. There's been plenty of drama in state capitals of late, as lawmakers face tight budgets and the specter of elections looming next year. As always, one of the main topics of conversation was public education. Now that the financial dust has mostly settled, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron reviews how lawmakers in our region have treated school budgets.
Let's start in Delaware, where the news was bad for public school advocates, but not as bad as it could have been.
Some of the cuts were passed at a significantly lower level than had been in the original budget bill that was filed earlier in the week.
David Blowman is the first state's Associate Secretary of Education for Finance. The original budget bill he's referring to called for a $37 million reduction in state aid to public schools. After an unusually long and contentious negotiation, Dover lawmakers eventually settled on a $26 million cut.
That reduction reflects about 2.5% of overall operating funds for school districts within the state. So certainly that's a much better outcome than districts were facing a couple of days ago without a revenue package on the table.
But while local districts got a little more than they might have expected, they got a little less flexibility. In Delaware, districts can't raise local property taxes without a popular vote. Originally, Governor John Carney proposed allowing districts to make small adjustments without a referendum. That proposal, however, fell through. In Pennsylvania, districts are allowed to make those small adjustments without voter approval, but they've often had to rely on big tax hikes to keep pace with rising pension and charter costs, says John Callahan with the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. This year's spending plan probably won't offer much relief. Pennsylvania did approve an extra $100 million in basic education spending, $25 million for special ed, and a final $25 million for more pre-K. That was welcome news given the Commonwealth's massive budget woes.
We've got to celebrate what we've got, but a broad spectrum-wise, you know, this is just kind of the bare minimum needed to make budgets work in Pennsylvania.
By that, Callahan means even these increases may be just enough to keep districts stable. What's more, that new state spending isn't set in stone. PA lawmakers approved a spending plan, but they haven't said how they're going to pay for it yet. That means over the next week or so, there will be a lot more back and forth.
It's going to be kind of busy. It's going to be pretty intense.
Pretty intense probably undersells the budget debate in New Jersey, which included a state shutdown and aerial photos of Chris Christie in a beach chair. Amid all the hubbub, there was some good news for education advocates. New money.
This is a good budget after 7 years of a long drought.
David Sierra runs the Education Law Center in Newark.
And I think it sets us up for the new administration coming into office next year.
Under Christie, state education funding remained largely flat, but this year lawmakers approved $125 million in new K-12 spending and another $25 million to expand pre-K programs. And that wasn't the only major move. Legislators also shifted money from districts they considered overfunded to those lawmakers believe haven't gotten their fair share, says John Mooney, CEO and education writer for NJ Spotlight.
Not a huge amount in a $9 billion school funding package, but it was really the first time these districts were getting some kind of significant raise in close to a decade.
With Christie leaving office in early 2018, that raise could have symbolic significance, says Mooney. It's a way for Democratic lawmakers to establish education funding as a priority before Christie's successor takes office, whoever that may be. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
And with year after year of funding struggles, school districts are frequently faced with cutting the extras in their curricula to balance their budgets. In Delaware, the school librarian has become an endangered species in recent years. As schools try to put more educators in the classroom, principals are increasingly eliminating the librarian, as WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
Every morning in the McCain High School Library in the Red Clay District, students and faculty converge on a coffee bar to order java and prepare for the day.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
McCain's coffee counter exemplifies how libraries have evolved in recent years. No longer just a quiet space for reading or cranking out term papers, libraries are for online research, collaborative learning, even video production or a caffeine jolt. McCain librarian Cindy Monger says it's the center of her school.
Students come here individually to work on various things, to do research, to apply for jobs. Teachers bring their classes here again for research, to use the computers, and also we are very popular in the morning.
The Christina District has no librarians or any staff in its 6 middle and high schools. Students can't go to the stacks of books unless a teacher takes their class. Newcastle County Votech has 4 high schools, but only one has a certified librarian. The others are staffed by a lower-paid paraprofessional. By contrast, all 16,000 students in Red Clay have a master's-level librarian in their schools, Supervisor Judith Conway says.
We are committed to libraries. Now, you know, with budget cuts, everybody has to take their share, but it's pretty much like our share isn't any different than anybody else's share.
Take Dickinson High. Its library has more than 12,000 volumes, literary classics, biographies, academic tomes, and books for students learning English, devotees of graphic novels, and those in the LGBTQ community. It's also a computer lab, study hall, makeshift film studio, coffee shop, and sanctuary for students to sort out emotions or find solitude, says librarian Debbie Suplee.
A lot of kids who have high anxiety in school and have a lot of trauma going on at home, and this is a great way for them to just come in and decompress. So they come in, they sit down, it might be at the end of a class period, it might be during lunch, and they just kind of mess around the puzzle.
Yet fewer and fewer of Delaware's 137,000 students have access to a librarian. A 2013 report said only half of the state's 250 public schools had one and concluded, quote, library services continue to deteriorate. There are even fewer librarians today, a situation the state's leading school library official calls dismal. Dickinson senior Joelle Wilkins calls the library her salvation.
I usually come to the library about every day. I have a really rough time staying in class where it's really loud, so I do my work usually in here, and it's quiet and I feel comfortable. It really helps me concentrate. Without the library, I would be completely lost.
Colonial District is taking a different route, spending $600,000 of taxpayer money at William Penn High to turn the library into an innovation center. No librarian and fewer books, but more online resources, meeting space, and a cafe. Conway counters that Red Clay libraries have modernized, organically and by design, with a librarian at the helm.
They're missing a lot. I mean, research has shown that if you have a certified librarian in the school, test scores are higher. And there's a good reason for that.
All over Delaware, it's a fight to keep or restore libraries. In many districts, it's been a losing battle. Chris Barish, WHYY News.
The cost of industrial development should not disproportionately burden poor or largely minority communities. That's according to the concept of environmental justice. Pennsylvania's environmental justice program was started more than a decade ago to give these communities more of a voice when oil refineries or landfills were built nearby, though the policy was written prior to the start of Pennsylvania's fracking boom, so none of the state's more than 10,000 shale gas wells were ever subject to it. From the Allegheny front, Reed Frazier reports that some environmentalists think it's time for that to change.
For Kirk Jalbert, the moment he started thinking about fracking and environmental justice was about a year and a half ago. That's when a gas company executive made an offhand remark at a legal conference that his company didn't frack in rich neighborhoods where residents could afford expensive lawsuits to fight the industry.
And, you know, within the way that we understand environmental justice, that will be, you know, an egregious admission of trying to skirt environmental justice rules.
The executive later called the comment a joke. But that got Jalbert thinking. Was this joke actually true? So Jalbert, an environmental data scientist who works with a nonprofit group, Frack Tracker Alliance, mapped wells in 3 western Pennsylvania counties. Out of nearly 800 wells, only 2 were drilled in places with median home values over $200,000. He found similar data on gas leases. Jalbert says there's a pattern here, but he doesn't know exactly why wealthier neighborhoods are less likely to have gas activity.
Is it because people have the means to not necessarily need to lease their properties for profit. They have other streams of income. Or is it because they want to maintain an aesthetic that people in poor communities don't have the luxury to maintain?
But Jalbert also found that only 5% of shale gas wells in the state were in places designated as environmental justice areas. Pennsylvania defines these as places with either 30% minority population or where 20% of the population live under the federal poverty line. Jalbert says people in many gas areas may not be officially poor, but they're not that far from it.
You're not seeing necessarily deep poverty, but you see what I call working poor and what other people call working poor, which is just above the poverty threshold.
The state's environmental justice policies were drawn up after residents in a largely black community near Philadelphia sued the state, which had allowed companies to build several toxic and hazardous waste facilities nearby. Once a community is designated as an environmental justice area, people get more say when it comes to developments that could impact them. Under the state's policy, facilities like landfills and power plants must provide extra opportunities for public participation. These include sending out more public notices and holding extra hearings. The intent is to give people who might not be able to afford a lawyer or take off from work to attend public hearings more opportunities to comment on a project.
Absolutely, absolutely. I would like to choose what was going in my backyard.
Kim Gifford lives in Dunkard, Greene County, near the West Virginia border. The town is in an environmental justice area. Gifford says she'd be in favor of adding oil and gas to the program. She lives less than a mile from the nearest shale gas well and is close to dozens more. But she also benefits from the gas industry. Gifford's husband is an ironworker who's working at Shell's ethane cracker in Beaver County, which will use the gas that's pumped from wells locally. Still, she would like to have some say in how the industry operates in her neighborhood.
I'm all for that. I think they should, especially so close to, you know, small towns. You got to worry about your water, your air.
In 2015, former DEP Secretary John Quigley said he would make sure the agency would include oil and gas in the environmental justice program. He said that it was justified because of concerns that increases in shale gas drilling could contribute to air and water pollution.
There's obviously a significant level of concern about the potential to harm public health, especially. And very frankly, I think it comported with the not only the definition of environmental justice that was operating at the time, but certainly where I thought the agency needed to go.
But the state hasn't gone there yet with oil and gas. Quigley was let go by the Wolf administration before he could enact changes to the environmental justice program. Quigley's predecessor at the DEP, Mike Crancer, declined a request for a recorded interview. But in an email, Crancer said he thought there were reasons drilling permits, quote, do not fit the original intent of environmental justice review. Crancer, who now works for a Philadelphia law firm that represents energy companies, said the program was designed to prevent companies from intentionally siting polluting facilities in poor or minority neighborhoods. With oil and gas, he said, companies don't have a choice of where to site a well. They have to put it where the resource is. The natural gas industry says the additional scrutiny would only hurt areas in need of money. The Marcellus Shale Coalition, in an email, said there was no need or justification to add gas wells to the environmental justice program. It says it would slow down what it calls an already slow process. By law, the DEP is required to issue permit decisions on gas wells within 45 days. But the current wait time, according to the industry group, is over 90 days. A few miles away from Dunkard, in the town of Mount Morris, Lori Haynes says she agrees with the gas industry. Mount Morris is not in an environmental justice area, but Haynes, who works as a teacher in nearby West Virginia, says she's seen families that were struggling, helped by the money they got from leasing their land to gas companies.
If we cripple what could be income for an area in an area that really needs income, I'm not so sure who that's helping.
The DEP says it's taking all this in. It recently completed a listening session tour around the state on environmental justice. Current Secretary Patrick McDonnell hasn't said yet whether he plans to make oil and gas an environmental justice issue. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front reports on environmental issues in Pennsylvania. This story is part of their series, Hazardous to Your Health, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh communities. There's a call out to aficionados of the nightlife. Make that the overnight nightlife. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the Barnes Foundation is hosting a performance called Abbott Adam Matins Lauds. Joining me to explain are Harry Philbrick, founding director of Philadelphia Contemporary, and Jaime Maceda, who along with Mark McLuhan comprise No Face Performance Group. Harry, Jaime, and Mark, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks. Why don't we start with Harry Philbrick? Philadelphia Contemporary is a rather new nonprofit. What was your intent in putting it together?
We're doing pop-up programming around the city, focusing on contemporary visual and performance art.
And how is it that the Barnes was chosen for this particular presentation?
Our organization is based on the idea of partnerships, and we were in dialogue with the Barnes about different ideas for programs we might do together, and I brought up the idea of the Abbott Adam Matins Lauds performance because it's an overnight performance, and I knew that the Barnes had done overnight when they first opened, so I thought they might be amenable to the idea.
Jaime, explain the title.
Abbott Adam Matins Lauds. So Abbott Adam is a larger series of works that we're making about medieval monasticism, and each of the pieces in the series corresponds to a different hourly prayer in the structure of monastic life. So Matins and Lauds are two of those prayer times. Matins occurs in the dead of night and Lauds at dawn. So the overnight structure of the performance encompasses those two hourly prayers.
Two hourly prayers, but the performance ostensibly runs from midnight to six. What happens during the other 4 hours?
So the overnight structure comes from a practice we developed where we alternate between periods of improvised performance, sleep, and then observing these two prayers or our approximation of them. So the centerpiece are these 2 hours, one of which is at three, the other at dawn, and in between we sort of compose on the spot a night in an abbey with sort of visitations, visions, nightmares, music, dancing, all sorts of different stuff.
Though of the three scheduled performances, only the final one will an audience be in attendance at. For the other two, streaming online, if you guys are sleeping, what are we hearing besides snoring?
Well, sometimes we do play music to cover those periods of sleep and kind of set a mood. But if you do tune in and we are asleep, that is really what's happening. We really will be asleep or attempting to sleep.
Speak to the difference between performance when the audience is merely online versus having flesh and blood attendees. From your vantage point, what's it like to perform when nobody else is there?
Well, this piece specifically, it did arise out of a private practice. So for almost 2 years, we were doing it with and never invited anyone. It was just something that was kind of between us. And it almost, I sometimes think of it as really at its heart, it's us performing for each other. It's 6 hours, it's long. So oftentimes the kind of skeleton of the piece involves us setting up surprises or fun experiences for one another. So when the audience comes, what we're trying to do is maintain that personal connection and that feeling of intimacy while allowing more people to witness it.
To witness and to experience it, I think the big question is not what it's like for us to perform for no audience, because we're familiar with that with this piece. The question is, what will it be like to have an audience? And I think the main difference between watching it online and in person, watching it online, it's a window into the practice, and you can see what it looks like, what material comes out of it. Coming to see it in person is a chance to experience what we're engaging in for yourself too, because we're inviting people to get as comfortable as they want, to come and go as they please, to drift in and out of sleep as we will, and to sort of experience firsthand the disorientation and temporal disruption.
So by contrast, the former is perhaps not the right term, but almost voyeuristic as an observer.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as we've done this practice in the past and have filmed it and live streamed it more, it has sort of become, in a way, a piece for video or creating situations that turn a certain attention towards the eye of the camera and people who may or may not be watching.
Harry, Jaime,
Mark, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Harry Philbrick, founding director of Philadelphia Contemporary. Jaime Maceda, who along with Mark McLuhan comprise No Face Performance Group. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The city of Philadelphia marked the 4th of July with a day full of events and ceremonies, beginning in the morning with a celebration of freedom in front of Independence Mall, and ending later this evening with a concert and fireworks along the parkway. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that a parade through Center City highlighted the city's diversity.
Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney often uses his public speaking events to take a verbal shot at the White House. This 4th of July, he did not mention the president by name, but his comments had a familiar ring.
In the United States of America, we are free to vote our elected officials. We are free also to speak out when we feel they are not representing our interests. We're also free to practice our religion, the religion of our choosing.
Kenney was there to present the Mayor's Magis Award to Vietnam War veteran Ralph Galati, who was a prisoner of war along with Senator John McCain. He now runs an organization to help returning war veterans. The ceremony, which also included an appearance by the group Boyz II Men and the Philly Pops Big Band, launched a parade that wound through the streets of Center City. Tens of thousands of people lined the sidewalks to watch, including Len Cornwall of Northeast Philadelphia, who comes downtown every year.
It's just part of Philadelphia. We stand in front of Independence Hall and, you know, all the patriotic stuff is great.
Tenora Rogers, a lifelong South Philadelphia resident, had never before been downtown for the 4th of July.
This is actually my first year coming in 35 years. There's so many different cultures represented, so many different states. It's wonderful. I love it.
The parade was a broad cultural swath of the city. It included traditional Latino costume dancers, Chinese dragon dancers, a mummer string band, and an African-American drill team, along with beauty queens, police and fire departments, and a contingent of patriotic characters from the movie Star Wars. Brian Callender came from Chicago, wrapped in an American flag. It was tattered on the edges.
This flag's been to 49 of the 50 states. One summer in 1996, I did a road trip and took this to the 48 contiguous states. Same with this hat.
This was the first time his flag had been in America's birthplace on America's birthday.
It's great just to be in Philadelphia on the 4th of July. This is sort of one of the bucket list items for us.
The city's festivities continue this evening with a concert and fireworks on the parkway. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and enjoy what's left of the Independence holiday weekend. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.